life present on Earth.
Strange Harbor, online at strangeharbor.net.
They say everything that we know, everything that we are, everything that we have comes from the people living on Nibiru.
Strange Harbor, be strange.
And another exciting episode of Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird. We talk about UFOs, alien abduction. We talk about Sasquatch and other cryptozoology. We talk near-death experience, ghosts, you name it. I am Johnny Manson, and she is MUFON investigator Cherie DeSeuss.
Keeping it real with UFOs.
And our guest today, I've been so looking forward to today, Mr. Barry Schwartz, the official documentary photographer for the Shroud of Turin Research Project. Welcome to the show, sir.
My pleasure to be here. Looking forward to it.
Can you tell us first, what is the Shroud of Turin, real quick, if that's possible?
Sure. Shroud of Turin is a 14.5-foot long, 3.5-foot wide sheet of linen woven in an ancient style, 3/2 herringbone weave, and it's claim to fame is that it bears the image of the full front and full back, ventral and dorsal images of a crucified man who's been scourged, speared in the side, crowned with a cap of thorns, scourged with a Roman flagrum. The scourge wounds literally cover his body, spear wound in the side. So everything on the shroud, forensically accurately, by the way, documents the tortures that were applied to Jesus of Nazareth. So many people believe that this cloth is the cloth that wrapped his body after he was brought to the tomb after his death.
So you accompanied some scientists, you being a scientist yourself. Do you think it's
sure.
the linen that was wrapped around just a dude? Do you think it was Jesus? What do you think it is?
Okay, well, first of all, let me preface that response by saying, first of all, you have to understand, I'm Jewish. I was raised in an Orthodox Jewish home, both my parents from Poland. So I had no emotional attachment to Jesus. And as a member of that team, when they first asked me, as a matter of fact, they said, well, do you want to get involved with this? And my answer was no, because I felt I didn't want to get involved with the religious thing, especially something that I knew little about. But they assured me this was a scientific process and that it was purely science. And the shroud does have one image property that attracted me, and we can get into that in a little bit. So to answer your question, do I believe this is the real thing? I do, but it took 17 years after we finished our examination in 1978 until 1995 before all the scientific evidence came in to a point where I became convinced that this most plausible answer to this piece of cloth is that it wrapped the body of the historical Jesus. I don't have a problem with that. I don't deny his existence. And again, our team didn't go there to prove that Jesus was the Messiah, or for that matter, that it was even Jesus. We just went there to try and figure out how is that image formed. The conventional wisdom was, well, it's most likely some kind of an artwork or a painting. Well, we proved it's not an artwork or a painting. One of the other theories was that it might be a scorch from a heated statue that scorched its image onto the linen. And we proved that was not correct by using scientific tests, ultraviolet fluorescence photography, and we won't have to go into too much detail there at this point. Mm-hmm. But we proved it's not a scorch. And the other theory was that it might actually have been made photographically, and we proved that that was not the case. There's not one iota of silver anywhere on that cloth that would indicate that a light-sensitive silver salt emulsion had been applied to that cloth at any point in its history. And the image has properties that no photographic image can have, that's something we can't do photographically. So it was all of the above, plus all the chemistry and physics and spectral analyses that were done by our team, that ultimately led me to believe that the most plausible answer is that this is the real thing.
Now,
Occam's razor, I think it's called, that the simplest answer is generally the correct one. And, you know, there have been so many theories about the shroud, from Leonardo did it, Sadly, that theory falls a little short, considering the Shroud is documented in historical record 100 years before Da Vinci was born. He was a good artist, but he wasn't that good. So I ultimately came to conclude in 1995 that the Shroud was most likely the real thing. And, you know, Sherlock Holmes, Conan Doyle in the voice of Sherlock Holmes said that if you eliminate all the possibilities, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, is most likely the truth. Similar to Occam's razor. And so applying that theorem, I came to the conclusion this has got to be the real thing.
So, but the last time we heard in our beloved media that they put in big headlines, Shroud is a fake. I thought...
That was back in... what year was that? 1980.
Yeah, they weren't as loud when they said, oh, they made a mistake. They didn't do the big, bold headlines there, though.
Well, that's always the problem. Shroud is a fake makes a much better headline. You're in the media. You understand that making a dramatic claim is going to get attention, saying that, hey, we have new science that, A, shows that the radiocarbon dating was incorrect. Well, that's not going to make a headline.
Yeah.
Even though there are now at least 5 peer-reviewed journal papers in prestigious journals, not just the kind on the internet where you pay $100 and they publish your work,
right,
but real peer-reviewed journals. And there's plenty of evidence now showing that since they only selected one little piece, one little strip of the Shroud at one corner to carbon date, that happened to be a corner where repairs had been done earlier on, and many of those repairs were undocumented because the Savoy family that owned it ultimately would cut corners off of it and sew it into replicas or copies of the Shroud that they permitted to be made and would give that as a gift for a dowry. And that happened in Portugal. I actually saw the dowry gift of a replica Shroud given to the royal family in Portugal, and in each corner is a little piece of the actual Shroud sewn into the corner to make it a relic.
Oh, wow.
So there's plenty of evidence that pieces were cut out. When you take a cloth woven like that and you start cutting it apart, it starts to unravel. You have to reweave it. And in that corner where they took the sample is strong evidence of reweaving. And cotton interwoven with the linen, which is forbidden by Jewish law, by the way, cotton interwoven with the linen, and that's because they then dyed the repaired area to match the rest of the Shroud color, and that repair, so that it wouldn't be obvious, they applied a dye. Well, the problem with linen is it's very hard to dye. Cotton is very easy to dye. So they interwove some cotton to make it easier to match the color of the newer replaced threads to the older original Shroud threads.
I always look for the latest information, but I also like to track, you know, where these things come from. And this Shroud was originally found in 14th century France. It didn't make it to Turin, the little city or big city now, in Italy.
Until 1578.
Right, where it's rested for over, 400 years now.
And where it must now remain, because the king who owned it, King Umberto II, mm-hmm, when he died, left it to the living pope, not to the institution of the church, but
right,
to the actual living pope,
right,
so one man could make decisions rather than 130 cardinals. There was one stipulation, and that stipulation the king made was it could never leave Turin.
Right.
It must remain in Turin. So
Walter McCrone, he's a chemist and expert in microscopy, is an independent analyzer of samples borrowed from your group, the STIRP group. He reported there was evidence consistent with pigments in the samples,
yes,
a sign that
correct.
Someone had drawn at least parts of the image, actually drawn them. There was
actually the pigments that Walter McCrone found were no greater concentrated in the image or blood areas as in the non-image areas. And if you were to scrape all of that pigment together into a pile, you'd still need a microscope to see it. That's how little there was. And Walter only examined sticky tapes that had been removed from the surface of the cloth. He never looked at the Shroud. He never saw the Shroud.
Mm-hmm.
And so, sure, we found particles there, and there are 54 documented occasions when an artwork was commissioned and laid on the shroud to sanctify it, and the transfer of some particulates from an artwork onto the cloth is explained by those 54 occasions. And again, as I said, it's randomly scattered across the entire shroud. You would expect a concentration of those in a blood area or in an image area, and that's not what we found. And remember, our data was taken from direct examination of the cloth itself, and that includes the spectral data, the infrared data. We did infrared thermography and infrared photography and ultraviolet fluorescence and reflectance photography and X-ray fluorescence. So all of those tests indicated no paints or pigments anywhere on that cloth other than the few microscopic particles of pigment that were inevitably deposited by these attempts to sanctify the cloth by laying onto it an artwork that had been commissioned most likely by the Savoy family.
Well, around 1389, Pierre de Cuz, the Bishop of Troyes in France...
Pierre Darcy.
He was talking about that there was actually someone who came forward and said it, they were the one who painted it, and that it was a fake.
Yeah. Very, very familiar with that, and that's really great. Most likely, he was talking about someone who had created a copy of the shroud. The problem with the Darcy Memorandum, which is what it's formally known as, is there's no record of it in the Vatican. According, supposedly, the bishop sent it to the Pope, but our folks who have examined the, believe it or not, I have a friend who goes to the Vatican secret archives and has access, and they've looked to see if there's any record of the Darcy Memorandum anywhere in the Vatican. Doesn't exist. No signed letters of that memorandum have ever been found. So although that's one of the things skeptics say, well, this guy says he knew the artist. Well, I'd like to meet the artist who can create a painting with no paint.
Well,
there's none on the cloth. So
Pope
the scientific
Francis.
Evidence says that's not correct.
Okay. Pope Francis still describes the Turin as an icon, not an artifact.
Correct.
Not a real deal, just an icon. The Catholic Church describes it as an icon. So the Catholic Church has not deemed it a well.
And I consider that the Catholic Church showing a little wisdom, because there's enough data now to dispute the claims of it being some form of artwork, but there's not enough data to prove how old it is. There's not enough data to prove how it was created. And to date, and I've only been involved for 44 years, no one has created an image with the same chemical and physical properties, even though every skeptic has tried to make something that looks like the shroud and have been quite successful. My photographs are all over the internet, so there's plenty of references. No one has created a result that has the same chemistry and physics as the Shroud of Turin.
I see. Okay. You know, I have to say there are many, many people out there over the years, the centuries, that have basically said that, you know, all this, although this is a very interesting piece or icon, that it couldn't possibly be true. Apparently... let's see if I remember the story right. Jesus disappeared.
Well, you know, nobody was in the tomb. Nobody exactly knows what happened.
Well, when they went into the tomb, he wasn't there, right?
That's correct. They opened the tomb, the body was gone. I don't debate where the body went, because that's far beyond my expertise.
So there are people who say that if the body disappeared under supernatural... kind of properties, that there's no way that the Turin shroud could be real, because that would be
Actually, some people say that the resurrection is what created the image, and that's another thing science can't dispute or confirm, because the scientific method says you cannot use an unknown to prove another unknown. The mechanism of resurrection is unknown, and the image formation mechanism of the shroud is unknown, so you can't use one to prove the other. What I always tell people is this. We went there to determine how the image was formed, and in the end, failed to answer that question. What we could tell you is what it's not. It's not a painting. It's not a scorch. And it's not a photograph. And that's been proven scientifically by direct examination of the cloth. Most of the people who have opinions on the shroud have never even seen it. Our data is taken by direct examination. And now some people have said, well, your team were a bunch of religious fanatics. Well, I have to laugh at that. There were three Jewish guys, a couple of atheists, a couple of agnostics, some Christians, a Mormon. And none of us were there for religious purposes. That was the reason that I said no when I first was asked to join, because I didn't want to get involved in that. Our team members represented Los Alamos National Laboratory, Sandia Laboratories, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. These are not a bunch of wacko scientists. These are a bunch of real scientists who apply the scientific method so stringently that they used to yell at me for just saying the word prove. Okay, we don't have enough data to say it's proved. And Ray Rogers, the chemist from Los Alamos, who was a dear friend, used to call me up and yell at me because I wrote something on our website that said we've proven something. He goes, we don't have enough data to say that. He made me more empirical than I ever was before. But one thing one has to remember is, look, these guys were professionals. And when people say, okay, well, some of your guys were Christians, so they inherited, you know, put an inherent bias into this. And I have to point out that when I point an instrument at a piece of cloth and I push the button to take a reading, that instrument doesn't care what religion I am, who I voted for. It doesn't matter to the instrument. It collects the data, and the data is published. That means that if anyone disagrees with our team's conclusions, they can go to the peer-reviewed literature, look at the raw data itself, and draw their own conclusions. That's what publishing in the peer-reviewed literature is all about.
So what were your conclusions on the Shroud of Turin?
The summary of our final conclusions is actually published on shroud.com. I don't have it in front of me or I would read it to you. But effectively, it said what I said briefly earlier, and that is that we have not been able to determine a mechanism that can create the chemistry and physics that we found on the shroud, but we definitely know it's not a painting, a scorch, or a photograph. So that was it. That was about as far as we could go. We made no further claims other than that the data that we collected did not yield enough information for us to draw any definitive conclusions other than excluding certain possibilities as being the probable cause of the image. We were the first and only team ever given permission to do an in-depth scientific examination of the cloth, multidisciplinary, non-destructive. And no one's been given permission to do that since. Our team had planned a second go-round because obviously when you collect this much data and you spend 3 years reducing it and publishing it into peer-reviewed literature, you raise a whole lot of new questions because you've collected a whole lot of new data. So our team planned 26 additional experiments, submitted a test plan, what we would have called then STIRP 2, and that was sent to Cardinal Ratzinger at the time, who became Pope Benedict years later. Cardinal Ratzinger reviewed that proposal of 26 tests, submitted it to the Pope, that was John Paul II at the time. John Paul II was consulted with his Pontifical Scientific Academy members. They suggested not allowing STIRP to do any further work on this route. They were fearful we might harm it, never mind the fact that we built a steel table to fasten the cloth on it with magnets so we'd cause it no harm. And when we got there, they took it off public display, and they had thumbtacked it to a piece of wood. And they were worried about us. But unfortunately, the Pope listened. They eliminated the 25 tests, many of which were designed to try and answer some of the new questions that had been raised by the data, and some that were designed to further explore with better technology what we had done previously. And all of that was canceled, and the only test they kept was number 26 that we had recommended, and that was radiocarbon dating. And of course, we know the results of that.
How did 3D imaging information get found on that?
Yeah, and that's the property that you can't duplicate photographically.
Right.
Cannot, when I take a photograph, and again, I'm going to assume now we're talking analog and not digital, because digital is a whole different set of rules. But in the analog world, which is what we operated in 1978, you know, today I was lecturing to fourth graders at a school some years ago up in Canada, and I had a 10-year-old kid put his hand up and ask me if film was a USB device.
So,
that made me feel kind of old. But going back to the analog method, when I record something on a sheet of film, what's being recorded is what's reflected off the subject matter and focused onto the film by a lens. Okay? What we have on the Shroud is different. There's a correlation, and I don't want to get too technical, but I'm going to say it. There's a correlation between image density, the lights and darks of the image, and the distance between the body and the cloth when the image formed. We know that the image is darkest where there was direct contact. But see, that's the mistake a lot of skeptics make. They say, well, you know, there should be a lot of distortion there. Yeah, there would be if this were a direct contact image. There would be what we call wraparound distortion. There's none in the Shroud because the image was formed by some interaction between the cloth and the body, and distance was a factor up to about 4 centimeters. That's it. So when you look at this, nowadays we can do it in a computer. Back in the early days, in the analog days, there was an instrument called a VP8 image processor, vector processor, 8-bit. So it had a very small grayscale, just 8 levels of gray. But you could input an image with a black and white camera, and it took that image and displayed it on a green screen monitor, and the instrument allowed you to take the lights and darks of the image and stretch them into 3D vertical space proportionate to themselves or to each other. And that yields the natural relief of a human form. So there's a direct correlation between the cloth and the body that it wrapped. That property cannot be reproduced photographically because distance is irrelevant. When I make a photograph, the lens focuses whatever I'm pointing it to the camera at onto the sheet of film, and you're done. There's no correlation of distance, but there is with the Shroud. So there was some interaction between the cloth and the body. My strongest belief is it was some form of chemical reaction. That was what Ray Rogers thought. He was a chemist, of course, so of course he was going to think it's chemistry. But that's the most plausible answer in my mind, from a scientific point of view, that there was some interaction between the cloth and the body, possibly a chemical reaction, which Rogers documented and wrote a paper on that's, again, on Shroud.com. So anybody who wants to dig into this, just look up Ray Rogers on Shroud.com and read his work, and you'll find the paper where he talks about what he called a Maillard reaction, which is a chemical reaction that gives beer its golden color and bread its golden color, well-known, documented for several hundred years chemical reaction that's used in commerce and places like that. And he felt that there was the possibility that that was the case with the Shroud, that the amines that escape from the body upon death, and they start coming out of your pores and your nose and your mouth almost immediately after death, ammonia and other heavier amines as the body begins to decompose, then you get putrescine and cadaverine, all the horrible smells of death. None of that is visible on the Shroud because, according to the Gospels, he was only in that tomb for about 36 hours. It says 3 days in the Gospels, but that's 3 days on the Jewish calendar, Friday night to Sunday morning. It's only about 36 hours. Not enough time in that climate for the products of decomposition to advance to a point of liquefaction, which we don't find on the Shroud.
We're talking the Shroud of Turin with Barry Schwartz. More coming up on Strange Harbor.
You're listening to Strange Harbor. Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. Strange Harbor. Be strange.
Welcome to Strange Harbor. If you've had an out-of-the-ordinary experience, then come to strangeharbor.net and let us know what it is.
It's Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird. We have Barry Schwartz, our guest today. We're talking about the Shroud of Turin.
Well, the interesting part is that during his crucifixion, or being crucified, things were thrown at him. Could have been beer, could have been any amount of things that were thrown at him. And, you know, that could stay on the body and also do a chemical reaction with the shroud. I have no doubt that there were probably a lot of chemical reactions going on.
But to create an image with the resolution that we see, that's always been the real question. How do you get that level of resolution? And let me also point out that in spite of what skeptics like to claim, the forensic pathologists who have studied the shroud, and there have been quite a number over the years. Probably the last most well-known one was Dr. Fred Zugabee, who was the coroner medical examiner of Rockland County, New York, for 35 years. And he spent 50 years studying the effects of crucifixion on the human body and applied that to his study of the shroud and determined that the blood stains and all of the wounds are forensically accurate. They're not painted on. No artist could paint that accurately. Blood flows a certain way. Zugabee was very familiar with that, having done 25,000 autopsies and examined countless crime scenes. So he knows, or knew, he's passed away now, he knew what constituted a natural blood flow or what might have been applied by the hand of an artist, and he felt that there was none of that, and that's true of all
the
forensic pathologists that have studied it. Again, that's not my field of expertise, so once again, I have to rely on people who are expert in that field. And, you know, Zugabee's credentials are such, as were Bob Buckland. Robert Buckland was on our team. He was a medical examiner of Los Angeles. They based the TV show Quincy on him.
Right,
he was a consultant on the program. And so we had some real high-quality people on our team that were qualified and credible. They had no other interest in it than to state what was obvious to them based on their expertise.
Did you find it interesting that the blood was red instead of brown like it should have been?
I did. As a matter of fact, that was one of the things that kind of kept me from accepting the credibility of the shroud being authentic, because old blood turns brown or black pretty quickly. If it's of any interest to you, I'll just throw this in at this moment. For 15 years, I was an imaging consultant at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I was working for the Laser Research and Technology Development Laboratory and spent a lot of time in ORs making videos teaching doctors the new minimally invasive techniques like laparoscopic appendectomies, lapapes, and lap colies, and things of that nature. And I had to produce the videos in the OR with the doctors performing it so we could teach doctors who were typically used to open surgeries how to perform a laparoscopic surgery, which, as you know, I'm sure, is radically different than the standard procedure in an OR for an open surgery,
even though
the lap surgeries are done in the ORs just in case they have to go in and open. Well, we had to teach the doctors these new techniques. I mean, just setting up an OR is a little different. It has to be a monitor over the shoulder of each of the doctors.
Right.
You know, so I actually went into ORs to show these techniques, and I always used to joke and say, not only can I say laparoscopic cholecystectomy, I can spell it. I wrote it enough times. The point simply is this. Look, the medical experts who, again, have examined this in great detail and depth, going back to the early 1900s and then into the 1930s, Pierre Barbet was a medical doctor. He worked with cadavers, and he came to the conclusion that what was on the shroud was accurate and forensically accurate, and that was 1930s. I think they reissued his book in the 60s or 70s just because there was interest in the shroud. So it goes back a long ways that the medical experts who have examined it said, like, this isn't an artwork. It's too accurate.
Your friend Ray Rogers, it's my understanding he had, like, little tolerance for bad science, and he often referred to people...
Well, that's putting it mildly.
the lunatic fringe. And
yeah,
you know,
that's what he called people.
People chiming in who specialize in rubber bands, but all of a sudden they're climate experts, for example, you know.
Absolutely. That's been the problem with the shroud for the longest time, which is why I like to point back to what we did, and I say, look, there are a lot of opinions out there about the shroud. People write whole books on the shroud, and they've never even seen it themselves, other than perhaps in photographs.
Right.
And yet our work was done, and what distinguishes what we did from everybody else, all our data was taken directly from the cloth. That's the first line of scientific evidence that one needs to look at before one goes any further down the road to start reading what Walter... look, I knew Walter personally, okay? I knew Walter. Matter of fact, the last time I spoke with him was about a year before he passed away. And I will be very candid with you, and I know we're on the radio, so people are listening, but I'll be very candid. Walter McCrone knew it wasn't a painting. He knew it wasn't a painting, but he was in a bad position. He told me, he said, "Wow, this whole shroud thing's driving me up a wall." And my response was, "Walter, maybe you should step back from the brink," because he had painted himself into a corner. The evidence proved it's not a painting. There I've used the word Ray Rogers. Hopefully he won't climb out of the grave and come and smack me for saying that.
Right, prove. You don't say that. Yeah.
We did prove it's not an artwork. That we did. I think Walter knew that. His business, the McCrone Institute, makes their living, 40 or so employees, by testifying in courtrooms as experts. He could never say he was wrong about that or anything else for that matter.
Right.
And so he had to stick to his story, but I firmly believe that he knew in the end that he was wrong.
And isn't there like a Jewish tradition upon death that you're cleaned, you're bathed?
Right, and that's probably...
Like if somebody was throwing beer on some guy in a cross, being Jewish, he would have been clean before he was laid to burial,
right,
wouldn't
right.
he be?
And look, and if Mary, his mother, was there, she was the ultimate Jewish mother, I'm sure she would have said to the disciples, even if it was a slight violation of some Jewish rules about a body being unclean because of the way it was he was killed, I'm sure she said, at least just wipe the dirt off of him, please.
Right.
And, I mean, that's what my Jewish mother would have said. By wiping the body off with a cloth, they re-wetted the bloodstains because blood coagulates and gets pretty firm pretty quickly. There was an experiment done and presented in a paper at one of the conferences a couple of years ago where the researchers went to an abattoir and got freshly slaughtered pig's blood literally minutes old. And the biggest problem they had was it coagulated before they could hardly do anything with it. So it coagulates pretty quickly. Now, those coagulants, past a certain point, the body stops making them. In other words, there comes a point after death where those coagulants are no longer in the blood, and the blood then will not coagulate the way it does with a living person. And those blood stains on the shroud probably don't show us how bloody he actually was. I believe there was a lot more there, that because of the wiping of the body, some of that was either wiped away or wasn't wet enough to transfer to the cloth. I don't recall the formal scientific name for that kind of re-wetting and transfer, but there is a name for it.
Right.
Jesus had over 300 wounds.
Mm-hmm.
And the Turin, actually, the shroud actually shows that, of all of these strike marks.
You know, the scourge marks, think about this. Every artwork we've ever seen of Jesus being scourged, and there are some out there, they show his back being shredded. Mel Gibson in The Passion pretty much showed his back being ripped to shreds. But if you're standing behind somebody with a three-thonged leather whip, and you take a baby step closer to that person while you're whipping him, some of those thongs are going to come around and hit the front of the body as well. Now, that's something most artists wouldn't think to do. And yet the man of the shroud has scourge marks not just up and down his whole back, but across his arms and his thighs and his side. Those thongs came around, hit him in the front as well.
That's right.
Now, that's way beyond the accuracy of most artists.
And what about the coins of Pontius Pilate in the eye?
I'm going to quote Ray Rogers again.
Yeah.
Ray Rogers said, "I think I see is not a scientific statement." And I have spent the last 40 years getting emails or letters or images from people telling me all these other things that they found on the shroud that, of course, actually aren't there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we call pareidolia. Our brains are designed that when we look into a complex image or pattern,
mm-hmm.
our brains immediately start to try and make sense of it by searching our pattern memories for something that looks familiar.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The minute we see something that matches something in our brain, in our memory, boom, that's what we see. That's called pareidolia. Do you mm-hmm. see the face of a man in the moon? Some people do. And so, and that's a perfect example of pareidolia. Here's the problem with the coins. There might be a coin on each eye. There might be. I'm not going to dispute that.
Mm-hmm.
However, you cannot resolve something smaller than the weave itself. And if you look at the inscription on the lepton coin that they have claimed to found on the shroud, you'll see the inscription is smaller than the weave of the shroud itself. The coin is only about the size of a dime or a thumbnail.
Right.
So it's not a very large coin. Imagine the size of that inscription, and it's smaller than the weave. Here's who said that. Don Lynn, who was on our team, had been head of imaging on Voyager, Viking, Mariner, and Galileo at Jet Propulsion Lab for NASA. He was the imaging guy on our team, the number one, my hero on the team.
Mm-hmm.
And as he put it, You can't resolve something smaller than the smallest pixel size, which in this case is the weave itself.
Right.
So
that makes sense.
I dispute that there's a coin inscription readable on the supposed coin, but I do admit that there is something there. It might be a coin. It could be a potsherd, a piece of broken pottery. We don't know. It could be a stone. It could be anything. But to say one can read an inscription, that's just not physically possible.
It's not possible.
I'm interested in the crown of thorns that is visible. I tried to find some information on whether or not Jesus was the only one who ever had a crown of thorns. And I guess...
And what did you find?
Nothing.
He proclaimed himself king of the Jews. And to humiliate him, they say, oh, you're the king of the Jews. Okay, well, here's your crown.
Yeah.
And there are bloodstains, not just in a pretty little circlet the way artists have always depicted the crown of thorns, but covering the entire scalp. They took a thorn bush and smashed it down on his head, and it punctured his scalp in multiple places. And we can see that, but not in the pretty circlet that artists typically use. And you know where that comes from. If you go back and you look at ancient artwork, whenever they depicted a Roman emperor, they always put a laurel wreath around his head. So all you have to do is substitute thorns for a laurel wreath, and an artist now has a motif to use to create his artwork. In reality, do you think they told the Roman soldiers that were crucifying him, listen, before you kill this guy, weave him a nice-looking crown so he looks good up on the cross?
Yeah.
Well, of course not.
Well, there was a suggestion.
So the crown of thorns stains on the head are one of the aspects that make me believe that this is most likely that man.
Right.
There's no other
right.
record, as you pointed out, of anyone else ever having that done.
No, there's not.
That's one argument, I think, that many pro-authenticists use to say, look, nobody else has ever had this done to him. This has got to be Jesus. Let me tell you something very candidly. When I finally decided to accept a position on the team, the very first thing I was thinking was, well, at least I'll get a free trip to Italy in the deal. That's how shallow my thinking was about. Look, I was raised in an Orthodox Jewish home. I had no emotional attachment to Jesus. I had no reason to look at this with any bias of it. If anything, I was biased against. I thought for sure we're going to get there, see the paint, and come home. And then it still took another 17 years before the evidence finally got me to say, well, I think the most plausible answer may very well be that this is authentic.
That and the fact that Jesus was 5'11", and the average height of a man was 5'5".
Yeah, actually, here's a problem with the measurements made of the shroud, and this is something that I have dealt with because now we're dealing with the image, and that's my field. So first of all, the shroud is on a herringbone weave, 3/2 herringbone. That means you can stretch that cloth in any direction a lot. The other problem we have with the shroud image, it has no defined edges the way an artwork would. It just fades out around the periphery. So where do you begin and end your measurements? How tightly have you stretched out the shroud before you made your measurements?
Right.
And as an example, in 2002, they did a restoration of the shroud, and they removed all the patches that had been sewn in 1534 by the Poor Clare sisters to repair the fire damage from the 1532 fire.
Right.
They removed all the patches. They removed the backing sheet. They scraped or cut away all the char around all the burn holes. They sewed a newer, wider sheet onto the back of it. No chemical analysis to see if that new sheet that was sewn to the back had been treated with anything that might be harmful. They didn't do that. And when they were finished, they also steamed out the creases that were in the cloth. And when they finished, they reported the shroud is now 7 centimeters longer than when they started. So measurements made from the shroud are not precision, and one cannot make precision measurements for those reasons.
Of all these unqualified skeptics, do you find them picking and choosing the science they want to accept and not accept, or do they...
Of course.
Okay.
It's called selective science.
Okay.
I understand that, but you can't ignore the data taken directly from the cloth. That's the foundation of the science of the shroud that's in the peer-reviewed literature. And I always tell people, look, doesn't matter whose book you're reading or what articles you're reading or what papers you're reading, go back to the data that was taken directly from the cloth. Start there.
The team's conclusions, your team, published in 1981, hint that the shroud's origins were beyond the understanding of science. There are no chemical or physical methods known which can account for the totality of the image. Nor can any combination of physical, chemical, biological, or medical circumstances explain the image adequately.
Think about who these team members were. These were guys who were explosives experts, weapons experts, bomb experts.
Right.
These were not a bunch of wacky guys. And
yeah.
for them to come to that conclusion, I think, says an awful lot that is even the best test that we could bring to that cloth in 1978
right.
could not answer the primary question we went to answer.
Well, the reason,
and that's why many of us still feel that another go-round like the STIRP 2 one that never occurred would be helpful to help answer some of the questions raised by our original data and to take the information and go further with it if we can. So I think that we're suffering from the fact that we're dealing with one set of scientific tests performed 43 years ago.
Right.
And the technology has advanced so dramatically in 43 years that some of the instruments we used back then are probably not even museum pieces. I mean, they're older, you know, they're just thrown away.
You were using optical processing, using a machine designed for NASA images. So you were...
Yeah, that's... I'm not sure where the NASA connection comes in. I think one reporter wrote, because we had two guys from Jet Propulsion Labs.
Right.
They said, oh, yeah, that VP8 image analyzer, they used that to map the moon, and that's all bogus. That's not true at all.
Fake news.
NASA had their own imaging stuff.
It's on Google. It's got to be true.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
Hey, listen to this. There is a dedicated group of skeptics on Wikipedia, and if you publish something on Wikipedia that's pro-authenticity, it'll be gone in an hour.
Oh, boy.
I believe it.
Welcome to the 21st century.
What about the hemoglobin? Was it hemoglobin found in the blood?
They found, hemoglobin and one or two other components of blood. Now, I will say this. The technology to analyze blood from back in 1978 until today is dramatically different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were just learning about DNA then and about some of these blood things. So now we have testing, and you can find on our website papers by Dr. Kelly Kearse, K-E-A-R-S-E, who is a PhD expert in blood and DNA. He has written some new papers saying that although the decisions made or the conclusions drawn by our team back at that moment in time with the technology we had, there are newer tests that could either confirm to an absolute certainty those results or deny them. So, again, a need for more testing using more modern technology might help to answer some of these questions and put some of these other ones to rest.
Well, it's unfortunate that this shroud is so old, because the things that we would test for have to be a little fresher than, 1,000 years or 2,000 years.
Well, and that's the other thing. I mean, even if we assume that it's only 700 or 800 years old, that's still really old for organic material.
That's right.
Especially because they used to hang the shroud out in the open air from balconies in the sunlight.
They ironed the damn thing. They used hot iron on it.
Well, they steamed it to get the wrinkles out. I'm not sure that they actually applied. I hope they didn't. Or there'd be some new scorches on the shroud, because there are actual scorches on the shroud.
Oh, good
and that
Lord.
I mentioned earlier that we proved those scorches that were on the shroud were authentic scorches, but the image was not a scorch. The problem is the color of the image itself is very similar to a lightly scorched area that's documented on the cloth from the 1532 fire.
Right.
So we used ultraviolet fluorescence photography, and in the UV fluorescence, all of the actual scorches on the shroud fluoresced in the red, indicating a high temperature event.
Right.
The image not only didn't fluoresce, it actually quenched the fluorescence of the background. The background of the cloth has a yellow-green fluorescence,
mm-hmm.
and all the high temperature event areas on the cloth, the scorches, fluoresce in the red. The image didn't fluoresce at all.
Interesting.
So it's not the product of a high temperature event.
No. Well,
so that's how we were able to eliminate scorching as an image creation mechanism.
You really did a great service by joining this group, because you can't be challenged for religious grounds.
Well, that's why the skeptics, guys like Joe Nickel, and I'm sure you know who he is.
Yeah.
Joe and I have appeared on radio shows together, George and Ori's show, and we were going to do another show together. George called me up and said, hey, you want to do another show? And I said, sure. He knows I'm up late, so I can do his show, no problem. And he said, how about a debate? And I said, sure, who do you have in mind? He said, Joe Nickel. Well, I'd already debated Joe once on his show about 2 years earlier. And so he said, let me give Joe a call. And about an hour later, I guess, he called me back, and he was laughing. He said, well, Joe immediately said, oh, I'd love to do your show. Of course I'll do your show. And then he said, well, we want to do a debate. And he said, yeah, with who? He said, Barry Schwartz. And Joe Nichols said, no thanks. And so I did the whole three-hour show myself.
Oh!
And so, well, look at what my initials are.
Yeah.
I'm on the radio. I have to be careful there. But if you look at my initials, look, I'm happy to talk about this. I'm happy because I don't have a horse in this race.
Right.
Guys like Joe Nichol, the first thing they bring up, Walter McCrone. Second thing, Darcy Memorandum. So you were true to form.
Yeah.
On the other hand, they always get to a point where once you start quoting the peer-reviewed science to them, they go, well, that's the rantings of believers. That was what I'm quoting, I think, out of Nichols' first book. That way they get to wipe away and dismiss all of the real peer-reviewed science because they're attacking the scientist. Well, that's what they normally say, but they can't say that about me because I'm not a Christian and I'm not a Messianic Jew and I haven't converted, although you can find on the Internet where it says I have. It's not true. And, you know, that's why you've got to be careful on the Internet. And the whole purpose of Shroud.com, and I think if you've been there, you know, that I promoted the books of the skeptics recently, Andrea Nicoletti and Luigi Garlaschelli. These are all big-time skeptics of the Shroud. And we list their materials and list their papers as well. Because my attitude, and I think I said it best when I first built that website 25 years ago, given the facts, I said, you have to make up your own mind about this.
Yeah. Doesn't
and
everyone?
My goal was simply to present them and give them access to the same data that I've been privileged to have and allow them to examine it. And if you want to dispute it, here's the raw data. Draw your own conclusions. 11 years ago, I formed the Shroud of Turin Education and Research Association, a 501c3 nonprofit.
STERA?
Any money going into the coffers goes to STERA, not to me.
What kind of stuff is on Shroud.com?
Everything there. There's all the major journals over the years that have published information about the Shroud. They're all archived on Shroud.com. We're getting ready to start archiving one in Italian. We have one in Spanish, and we have several in English. The whole idea is to collect the data, put it all in one place, so that somebody who wants to study the Shroud can sit down on one website and spend, I always say, if you're going to visit Shroud.com, pack a lunch and a snack. you're going to be there a while.
That's a great service.
And the whole point is to make that data available to everybody so they can make up their own minds.
Well, that'll do it for this episode of Strange Harbor. If you'd like to know more about the Shroud of Turin, Barry Schwartz and his work. If you want to know more about Disclosure, the latest Sasquatch sightings, UFO encounters, or if you just want to contact us and yell at us for being tinfoil hat wearing whack jobs, log on to strangeharbor.net.
You're listening to Strange Harbor. Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. Strange Harbor. Be strange.